Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. Hope you're having a great 4th of July. I don't even really know. Is this the 4th of July weekend or is it the next one? Next one? Who cares, right? I mean, they're both going to be great weekends. We'll just say that. It's good to have you here. We're going to be in Nehemiah 11 and 12 today. We're not going to read every verse of both chapters, and I'll explain why here in a moment, but that's going to be the block of work that's going to help us the most today. And while you're turning to Nehemiah 11, I learned recently of this crazy disorder I'd never heard of before called prosopagnosia, otherwise known as face blindness. Maybe some of you have heard this. It's terrifying when I read about it. It's some cognitive disorder that makes it impossible to discern the facial features of other people. So you see people, but you don't recognize them. This extends to like family and friends, and in some cases when you look in your mirror. So it works like this. You walk in a room and you see 10 people, but all the distinctions are washed away from their faces. So it's like looking at 10 emojis or blank slates or something like this. Again, I couldn't imagine such a struggle. It sounds frightening to me, but it is a reminder to me of how broken creation is, how paradise, when it was lost, was truly lost in the Garden of Genesis, and how awesome it's going to be when paradise is regained. I mean, creation is so broken that something like that exists, and new creation is going to be so awesome because nothing like that will exist. But it made me wonder, as I was reading, and I don't know how I found it, and I just couldn't drop it. I just kept reading and reading and reading, you know. But it made me wonder, as I was studying the passage for this week, when it comes to God, how easy is it for you to believe that he cannot see your face? I don't mean visually see your face, but know who you are as an individual, right? Individually. See, demographers speculate that there's been about 120 billion people who have ever lived on earth, counting today. So when God looks out across a landscape of people, does he know who you are individually? And I think maybe even more important than just our name is our story. Does he know the texture of your life so far? What's haunted you, your fears, your hopes, your dreams, your regrets, your addictions? Does he know who you are, or are you an emoji to him, just part of a bigger group? You know, I think too much of the church thinks that God has prosopagnosia, that he is all-seeing, but he doesn't really see it all. He's just a big God that sees a big glob of people, and I think that this is dangerous, really. I mean, there are ramifications to how we think God sees us. And if we know that God knows when we live and where we live and why we live when and where we live, then it will affect our lives differently than if we just feel like we're an anonymous piece of a big group of people. But the truth is he knows all, and he knows all very deeply, very deeply. I mean, this is actually another reason I think the gospel is such beautiful news, is because when God came to rescue me, he did so even with his deep knowledge of who I am. He knew my potential, he knew my floor, he knew my ceiling, he knew my gift set, he knew my personality, he knew everything because he actually created it. I think we might have this image of God finding us, changing us, and then having this real moment with himself saying, man, I'm not sure this was a good investment. I'm not sure about this guy, this gal. I thought they'd be a little bit more impressive. They advertised a little differently. We think that God is going to have buyer's remorse when it comes to us being a part of his family. And I think we're all always a little bit afraid anyway of being found out to be a fraud, but even more so with God. Do you feel like God feels ripped off by him bringing you into his family? You see, the gospel story, one of the more beautiful angles of the gospel story is that we were deeply known as enemies long before we were deeply known as friends and family. And that's a great comfort to me. It's a great comfort to know that God knows us so tightly and completely. But here's a rule of life, maybe a rule of thumb. That which does not bring you satisfaction vertically, we will always extend horizontally and try to get from creation. In any area of your life where you are not satisfied, not content in the Creator, you will try to extract and pull it from creation. And this is one of those areas where that is true. We will break our marriages because we do not feel deeply known by our spouse like we want to be deeply known. They don't get us. They don't understand us. And so it drives a wedge. We break friendships doing the same thing. We feel so unknown by our friends, so alone in a room full of friends. We can even get depressed because we feel anonymous or left out. The whole time, what we're trying to do is just replace a deep knowledge that God has for us with each other. And it breaks something that could be very good, something that could be beautiful. I think this is pertinent with where we're at in our story in Nehemiah, because we're in our final chapters. We're in the eighth inning with Nehemiah right now, and he's rebuilding a people that the book has been referring to as a group, a herd. We've read about a people of God or a covenant people, but it's always been in plural form. But does he know who you are away from the herd as an individual, or do you think that he sees you and just feels ripped off? So what we're going to do is we're going to let this passage lead us today, because it's not a small thing how you see God seeing you. It's not a small thing. So we're not going to read all of it, but I do want to kick into verses 1 through 3 and then talk about it a little bit, because this is where we're at in our story. And this is the word of the Lord for you and me. Now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in the other towns. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. These are the chiefs of the province who lived in Jerusalem, but in the towns of Judah, everyone lived on its property in their towns. Israel, the priests, the Levites, the temple servants, and the descendants of Solomon's servants. Okay, what's going on? Back in chapter 7, you probably remember us talking about how the Bible says that the city was wide and large, but the people within it were few and no houses had been rebuilt yet. The people just weren't living downtown yet. Why? I mean, downtown is the coolest place to live, right? Wrong, apparently. I mean, we always move to the suburbs, even back during these times. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's super cool to wake up in your condo and walk your dog down to the farmer's market. Until you have your third kid and your second minivan and you just want to grill a burger on your own backyard, you know, and park 7 feet from your door, then it's not so fun to live downtown. For us today, it's a matter of convenience that might drive us to the suburbs, maybe cost, but back then in the ancient world, it was actually for safety. It's safer for them back then to live in a little cluster of houses outside of the city walls, because a marauding army would come in, but they wouldn't bother going up and attacking 17 little homes up on a hill. That wouldn't happen. I mean, think about it today. I mean, if North Korea, if it was like Red Dawn, I don't know if you remember that movie, but if Red Dawn happened and North Korea parachutes in, hey, they're not attacking Alcoa. They're not going there. They don't care about Powell either. They're going to, and I know Powell's growing, it's super impressive, but they're going to go to the city county building downtown. That's where they're going. I mean, to be downtown is to be in danger whenever there's a marauding army. It was even more so back then. The vast majority of people lived in these scattered splotches all around the city, but not really living in the city. The populace was spread wide. They were in the suburbs. We could say that pretty accurately. They were in the suburbs. And this, incidentally, is why I think Knoxvillians can understand this passage far better than a lot of people can, right? I think we have access to this passage a little differently. It's only been in the last 25 years or so that our downtown has seen the rapid development that it has seen. Some of you who are lifers, you were born and raised here, you remember a different downtown when you reach back into your memory. Nobody was looking to go downtown and live or eat or anything else. Jerusalem, just like Knoxville 25 years ago, is experiencing what's called a reverse donut. The donut effect, when it comes to population, is when a city center starts to shrink and atrophy and close in on itself, while at the same time, density goes out to the suburbs. Why? Because it's easier, it's cheaper, you have family contacts out there. And what does it do to the middle of the city? Well, it leaves it vacuous. So people were moving out, but now in our story, people are flowing back in. But just like then, today, when people start flowing back into the city's center, it takes a courageous people, a people with some vision to do something like that, because you're not sure if it's going to work out or not. It just doesn't look great. None of the houses had been built yet. Again, think about a Happy Holler or a Baker's Creek. right? I mean, it was not cool to live there until there were 7 breweries and 5 bike shops and a couple exotic butchers. Some of you, you still don't know about Baker's Creek, and it's because you're not cool enough to know about Baker's Creek yet, right? But apparently that's the cool place now to live. Nothing is different. We get this. Even if you did see that money was flowing in, even if you did see that that would be a great place to live, you're still sitting on a mortgage. You still have a yard. Chipotle is just a couple blocks down. The schools are better. So people aren't really looking to move back in. It's not a whole lot different, and it's something that we understand. Jerusalem is in the very beginnings of this reverse donut effect, and not everyone wants to go. So they're drawing lots. They're tithing into the city. What is drawing lots, Luke? Well, it's just like flipping a coin. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but not really. It's just leaving things up to an inanimate object to discern for us what we should do, right? We see it in the book of Jonah. We see it all throughout the Bible, this casting of the lots. And what it does is it shows their submission to the sovereignty of God, God deciding what he sees fit from family to family to family. Hey, just side note, are we supposed to cast lots anymore? Sounds like a pretty easy way of making decisions, right? Flipping a coin? The answer is no. We don't need to do that. The last time you see casting lots mentioned in your Bible was replacing Judas with Matthias, right, as one of the 12 disciples. We saw it then, but that's the last time you'll ever see it in your Bible. We actually have a complete Bible now. We have the indwelling Holy Spirit, right? So that helps us make our decisions. Even now, if you find yourself trying to decide whether to go right or left, all things equal, and they're both fine, there's no moral component to them, and all your counsel is kind of split, just do what you want. There's no wrong answer. There's no wrong answer. Just do what you want. I almost wrote a blog on this, and I thought, no, that's dorky. I could probably say it in 2 minutes, and that's what I just did. That's everything I think on casting lots. You have it right there. The main idea is that they tithe themselves into the heart of the city for the good of the city. And capital A, and some went willingly. Willingly. Different sermon, but leaders go first and they tackle the hardest. That's what we see in this passage. Leaders do not wait to be asked. Leadership will always take the shape of Christ as well, because he is the greatest leader who has ever lived, right? I mean, just think about his life. And as I say these words, think about what a current leader could look like. Someone who goes first, at a great cost to self, for the benefit of others. It's sacrificial initiative that they take. They're even taking responsibility for a mess that's not even their own. At the whole time, keeping the vision close in front of them, not being persuaded to the right or to the left, and they're very aware of others. I've got shelves full of books on leadership, organizational leadership, personal leadership, one-on-one leadership. Listen, you don't need a bunch of books. They all start to sound the same after a while. Even the ones that are far from Christ, all they can do, if the best ones, they describe the shape of Christ. Because, again, he's the greatest leader to have ever lived. You know, I talk a lot about recruiting volunteers from the stage. We need volunteers for the kids ministry. We need volunteers for our tech, for the stage. We need comm group leaders. We need things like, listen, it's not really volunteers I'm looking for. It's leaders. It's leaders. It's not volunteers, it's leaders. Here's why. Because we have a city to change. I'm looking to make war with the enemy and with our sin, and there's a city to change. And it's not just basic volunteers just doing basic things. We need people who will go first, right, and take the initiative. That's, again, a different sermon. I want to jump into this in verse 4 by telling you we're not going to jump into verse 4. This passage will give you 150 names and over 75 verses, right? That's a lot. Luke, did you count them all? No, I didn't. But I started to, and then I asked ChatGPT how many names were in there, right? And I have to tell you what it told me. I have to. This is what it said. This is me. ChatGPT, how are you? How was your day? Comma. How many names are listed in Nehemiah 11 and 12? This is the first answer it gave me. To determine the exact number of names, one would need to manually count each name mentioned throughout these two chapters. Unfortunately, there isn't a readily available tally provided in the biblical text. And I'm thinking, well, so I said, what would the tally be if there was one? I mean, I had to just ask like 5 more questions to just narrow it down. and then it finally told me 150. And this is why, because even ChatGPT was overwhelmed with this list. Even it was like, oh gosh, it's so many, why do I have to count? And I understand, right? Why all the names? Why? And why does Nehemiah keep doing this? By the way, this is the fourth time we've bumped into a gigantic list, is it not? Why? Why is Nehemiah's journal so interested in copy-pasting so many names repeatedly? Bigger question, why do you care? Why do we care? I say it all the time. I believe that the Bible answers all of our burning questions, at least the ones that really matter, right? So what burning question does this answer? And I don't think it's immediately evident, right? I mean, take this cat I found in verse 17, Bakbukiah. Way down in verse 17, tucked away. He's a Levite. Apparently, he can sing a little bit. He is the equivalent to the assistant to the regional manager for Mattaniah, who could lead worship and did. And I read that, and I think, I'm happy for him. Interesting, but not really interesting, right? I'm kind of uninterested in what's going on in this guy's life, but there it is. What do I do with that? Here's our big takeaway. God knows our names and how we will fill our days. Down to an individual. God does not suffer from face blindness. Not only are we not invisible to God, neither is our service to God. In this passage, we see singers in verse 27 forward. We see managers in the same passage. We see gatekeepers in verse 19, priests. In verse 10, Levites in 21, we see landscapers. Everyone played a part in a very big picture. You see, Bakbukiah here, he's not just a guy, somebody's son. He's got wrinkles in his history. He's got skeletons in his closet. He's got hopes and dreams. He had friends, right? Probably had a dry sense of humor in a great pickleball game, right? He's probably a 6 on the Enneagram. He was a guy. He had ambitions. He struggled. This is what we know, though. Bakbukiah was born when he was, where he was, doing what he did with the people that were around him, all according to God's watchful, beautiful, creative, providential care of history. Do you ever think about that for yourself? I do. Why were you born when you were and not 1920 or 1620? Why? Why born to the parents you were born to, in the place that you were born to? Why would God do that? David says in the Psalms, "In your book were written all of my days, those formed for me before any of them started." The sovereign design of God over our lives, it cures a million ills, friend, for you and me, when it comes to being known. And if we don't believe this, if we don't believe we're created to be who we are, where we are, doing what we are called to do, then we're always going to try to be someone else, somewhere else, doing something very different, and we're never satisfied with what we're doing in the moment. It becomes this flaming discontent. It's not ambition. Don't lie to yourself. It's a discontent. It's a mistrust. We'll always assume others are more important than us. We'll always ascribe value to those who are spectacularly gifted, to those who are most visible. And the narrative we'll carry in our head is, God, why didn't you make me like them? Why didn't you make me like them? They're so meaningful and significant, and I am not. 1 Corinthians has a beautiful passage. I want to read it. It's a great tag-along passage for this part. It's going to be in verse 14. Let's do that. 12, 14. Stay where you're at if you want. This will be up on the screen. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the sense of hearing? And if the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them, as he chose. As he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? And as it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor again the hand or the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty. which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no divisions in the body. And then he goes on and on. I love this passage, and here's why. Because it gives me a sense of responsibility and release at the same time. Responsibility, because I understand I have a part to play. It's indispensable. It's part of the whole. It's not easily lost. But it gives me a release because I have limits, right? I've got limits. And my small talents, my small service is still seen by God. You see, what it does is I'm not to neglect my acts of service, but I'm not to be defined by them either. It brings a lot of release to me. Because we're all prone to a little discouragement or despondency. I mean, does anyone see what I do? That's what we tell her. Does anyone see what I do? Am I even noticed? Like, if I disappeared, how long would it take for people to know that I'm not even there? And if no one notices me, then do I matter? Hear me now. That's a sin. That's a sin, friends. That's pride. It's not just being self-aware. It's being self-infatuated. We've said before, probably one of the better definitions ever given on humility. It's not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. We've heard it a million times. Jesus bled to cover both of those sins of pride. The ones that we can look at and say, that dude is prideful, where he's just self-magnifying. And then the one that is just so decomposing inside because nobody sees me, nobody loves me, and all they can think about is that. It's both pride. He bled to cover both. And that's going to require some repentance from a lot of us today. But I would also like to encourage you, if that's you, if you feel small, forgettable, insignificant, listen, it will be the smaller, consistent, present, long obedience, the type of service with no neon lights attached to it that will change cities. It will be done through inconsequential people, forgettable people. They will be the ones to do the work. I don't know if you know about this or have heard of this guy, but in 1855, there was a guy named Ed Kimball. No one's ever heard of this guy. His uncle owned a shoe store. This guy, Ed, worked at a carpet store. And he walked into his uncle's shoe store in Boston and found a young dude in the back room stocking shoes. And he knew this guy because he was a Sunday school teacher. So this Sunday school teacher told this 18-year-old guy about Jesus, and this guy gets radically saved right there in the back room, in the stock room. That guy is D.L. Moody. Moody became a powerful evangelist. Some of you probably have heard that name. He was most effective in the Northwest and in Europe, just a little bit in Europe. He's probably also more well-known by Moody Publishers or the Bible Institute, the Moody Bible Institute. Those are still thriving, by the way. But he was also a circuit preacher. And on one of his preaching moments, in one place, he was stopped by a young guy named Wilbur Chapman. Wilbur Chapman showed up to the meeting early, a lot earlier than everybody else, and he asked him to sit down and help him feel comfortable with his salvation. So he does. He sits down. You've got Moody, you've got Chapman, and they go through the book of John together to the point where Chapman says, man, I wasn't sure if I was saved, and maybe I wasn't, but now I know that I am. And with this deep assurance, Wilbur Chapman then begins working alongside Moody on the same preaching circuit, mostly up in the Northeast. And one day, this guy, Wilbur Chapman, preaches from a street corner in Chicago. And listening, within earshot, is a guy who's not working. He's on his day off, leaning up against a bar. He played center field for the Chicago White Stockings. His name was Billy Sunday. And as he was there listening, he recognized some of the hymns that were kind of coming through that downtown air. He remembered them from whenever his mom used to sing those same hymns. So he gravitates towards this street corner, hears the gospel, and is radically changed right there on the spot. God changed him. Billy Sunday eventually ended his Major League Baseball career to take a job with the YMCA and then himself jump on a preaching circuit, right? And one of his most influential disciples was no longer up in the Northeast. He was up down in the South. Mordecai Ham, that sounds like a southern name. He'd carry revival south of the Mason-Dixon line and be more impactful than most anyone that had ever come before him. Actually, a lot of his work was not far from here in Knoxville. Luke, this is painful. What are you doing, right? Listen, it's going to be Mordecai Ham that would extend the gospel to a lanky young Billy Graham. Billy Graham would go on to declare the gospel in over 400 crusade events, reaching billions, still to date. No single human being has preached the gospel to more people in the flesh than Billy Graham. It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to the point where his ministry would affect Bill Bright, who started Campus Crusade, or Don McLennan, who started FCA. So the college campus is never going to be the same again, right? Also coming from this fertile soil in Southern California that Billy Graham spent most of his time, where it was the seabed of what we call the Jesus movement, which that's a wave we're still riding. Anytime you come to a city or you see a sign that has Calvary Chapel or Vineyard Church on it, that came straight out of the Jesus movement. Sprouting from this Jesus movement was a church planted in the Sandpiper Motel in Midland, Texas. Now it's a megachurch. Back then it wasn't. And that church would preach the gospel to me. I would become radically born again. And that would plant a church in a movie theater in Tampa Bay, Florida. They would plant Legacy Church. They would plant Citizens Church. And the story's going to keep going on, and it's going to keep going on. Here's the question. Who is spectacular in this? Who is spectacular? We say Billy Graham. It's obvious. That's the layup, right? It's Billy Graham. I say Ed Kimball, the Sunday school teacher that ventured into the back room of a shoe store to challenge an 18-year-old. Here's the point. It will always be people we've never heard of. People we've never heard of. Those who set up chairs in the YMCA before Billy Sunday went out there. Those who worked out the logistics for Billy Graham's work, or even more, prayed in the back room while he was preaching. Listen, I get the honor of preaching, I don't know, 75, 80% of the year up here, but can I let you in on a secret? This body has many members, as Paul says. It's full of heroes. They not only serve, but they serve under the traumas of normal life. You know, I think of the Ludies. I think of David Person. You know, he's back there all morning fighting these cables, and they can fight pretty hard, fighting the sound. And here's the thing, whether it's our worship team or our setup and tear down or people that are laptoping all over, we got so many laptops, so many volunteers. Some of you who volunteer here, you take hits. You live life. You got relatives in the hospital. You got kids that are struggling. You work long, hard weeks, and then you show up and you serve. And if you wonder if God sees and God knows, I'm telling you, not only does he see, he has designed you for such a time and a place, and it's through your long obedience and careful service that people's lives are changed. People's lives are changed. We have an army of women serving with our kids back there. Because we have 100,000 kids, right? Some of you are alive in the 80s. I always think of gremlins. When a gremlin gets wet, it's just like five new gremlins come out. That's how we do kids here at Legacy Church. There's so many of them. So we need 1 million volunteers. But man, how many Mordecai Hams are back there right now? How many Billy Sundays are going to hear the gospel in some level or some seed form and then have a recall when there are 22 on the college campus, or 32 when they're at the end of their wick with a family that's just not working out very well, and they get radically born again? How many? Friends, my Sunday school teacher was an accountant. His wife was an English teacher. They'd watch me show up every Sunday and raid the donuts and flirt with the girls and act like a toddler, and they would invest. And they would show up the next week and they would invest. They would sow. They would get no thanks. They would be tired. They'd hit repeat. For years they did this. It's the unremembered, unsensational, unseen work by people you don't even know that will rip through broken creation with the song of the gospel. That's how God builds. That's what we know from the Bible. Somewhere you and I picked up this idea that only the gifted and the omnicompetent are the ones that do that, that they're the only ones. The sensational leave a mark on history and no one else. That's simply ridiculous. Simply ridiculous. It's ridiculous to believe that you have to have some level of competency on that level, omni-gifted. In fact, the Bible makes a big deal pointing the opposite way. King Saul was a head shoulders above everyone else. Stronger, smarter, better looking, could command a room. And it was the beginning of the disastrous downturn of that kingdom. Nehemiah has been a story of how significant ordinary people can be. That's what we've seen chapter after chapter. And it shows up in the New Testament as well. Check out the disciples. Not such an impressive gang, right, in the beginning. Simply showing up, playing a part, committing, following through, trusting the Lord that it's all according to his plan and being content with what the Lord does. I mean, friends, just take an honest look at your last week, week and a half maybe. Was it super sensational? Did you have a lot of crazy, spectacular things happen? No? Me neither, right? I had a couple notable things, but 98% of it's just the same stuff. That same stuff, however, is the material of history making. Make no mistake. Same route to work, same small office, same office smell, same looping conversations with everyone else on the cul-de-sac. And we think to ourselves, one day my life is going to take off. One day the drama is going to come and I will be seen. Meanwhile, as you take out the trash, as you do set up and tear down, as you read to your kids every night, you are making history. If God sovereignly arranges the members as he chooses, as Paul says, and as I believe, then you are right where you need to be, and we need you to build. You are right where you need to be. Know that he sees you, he sees your service, he sees the shape of your prayer. But here's my question for you. Are you prepared to be totally unseen? Are you prepared to be totally unseen? I mean, that runs counter everything the world tells us. The world has a way of ascribing value and importance, and we've picked it up. And we say that's true for me as well. But are you prepared to live your life in such a way that no one knows your name or cares or gives you any thanks? Are you prepared to disappear into the margins of kingdom expansion? Because that's what our very calling is. If he decides to make you an ear or an eye or a foot or a hand, that's his prerogative. It's his beautiful creativity. As I've said before, I find a very odd but real joy in not being a footnote in history, but being totally forgotten about and unremembered. I'm comforted by that. I'm actually comforted by the fact that no one eventually will know who I am but God. That no one will ever see what I've done except for God. Luke, that's crazy. That's a little psycho. No, it's comforting to me because I don't shrink if I don't get applause from you. If I don't get accolades or a high five from you, I don't come apart inside. And if I don't demand you love me, then I can finally love you for the first time. I could empty myself for you. Hebrews 6, it says this, "For God is not unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints as you still do." You know, there's this quirky moment in Luke 10, I believe, where the 72, Jesus had sent out 72 people to do ministry. So we're talking about demons coming out and healings and just crazy craziness going on. And when they all come back, of course, they saw such craziness that they just couldn't wait to download it all with Jesus. Oh, you wouldn't believe what we saw. It was one of those moments. We've all had moments like that where it's just like there's so many words to get in and everyone's all hopped up. And Jesus says, listen, don't rejoice that you saw spirits submit. Rejoice that your names are written in heaven. I've always loved that passage. It's a totally different sermon. Hey, we're going to have days where the spirits just don't seem to be submitting, where life is just tripping all over us. We're going to have days where it doesn't feel like we're getting anything done. If you rejoice and you attach your significance and your self-content life to what you're able to produce, you will have bad days just like you will have good days. What he is saying is your deepest source of contentment and satisfaction should come from the fact that you are loved and known by God. You see, there's another list, more important than the one we're looking at, with far more than 150 names on it, all known, not just their names, but the people on them, their stories, their actions, their words, their worship. These entries were placed carefully before seconds even started ticking. Revelation refers to it as the Lamb's Book of Life. Your name was inscribed in it because of the work of Jesus, a far better Nehemiah. Right? He entered humanity, by the way, without having to wait for lots to be cast. Why? Because he took initiative. It was a sacrificial move. Again, he's our most beautiful leader. It was more than just a tithe of God into a city that needed just refurbishing. He was God's fullness that came to you and me. Our great leader was pleased to come sacrificially, to take responsibility for a mess he did not create. And he incurred a great cost to our great advantage. This means I'm seen. I'm loved. You are too. And there's nothing you can do to add to that value. So, friend, that means you're free to be unremembered. You're free to be forgotten. You're free to serve and serve and serve. Never have your name recorded. to never get a thank you. You're free to be forgotten. Why? Because you have everything you could ever want. If you suffer from feeling small and inconsequential, and that's got you paralyzed, trust that God's knowledge of you is beautiful and complete, and it is satisfying, and that creation's knowledge of you is fleeting. So show up. Serve. Presence matters. Small, consistent ways. But think about it. You all have shoe stores. We've all got cul-de-sacs. We've all got YMCA moments, street corners. You could change history with your faithfulness, even if it cannot be measured today. Small acts, a conversation here, a big risk you took here, over there, just showing up, just being over and over and over again, even though it might be invisible. You know, we see at the end of this passage that not only are we counted individually, and not only does our service and role matter, but so does our worship. I'm going to go back and finish with two verses, and this is going to be in Nehemiah 12, Nehemiah 12, 43. So we did a little bit at the beginning, and I'm going to do a little bit at the very end, and then we're out. 12, 43 says this, "And they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and children also rejoiced, and the joy of Jerusalem was heard far away." Either joy or rejoice was mentioned five times in one verse right there. "On that day, men were appointed over the storerooms, the contributions, the first fruits, and the tithes, to gather into them the portions required by the law for the priests and for the Levites, according to the fields of the towns. For Judah rejoiced over the priests and the Levites who ministered. And they performed the service of their God and the service of purification, as did the singers and the gatekeepers, according to the command of David and his son Solomon." Again, joy is mentioned five times. There was no small amount of joy here. It was so vibrant and heavy, they said that it was heard from far away. This joyous worship, it took different shapes. Praise, worship, sacrificial giving. You see, Jesus builds the happiest people in the world. He builds the happiest people in the world. But you're never going to find that happiness wishing you were someone else, somewhere else, hating who God has made you to be. I mean, is this hard for you to be happy right now, to be joyful? You know, a rule of thumb you find in the Bible is that praise always follows thanksgiving, or oftentimes it will follow thanksgiving, right? Just ask yourself, what am I thankful for today? As we're about to enter into song, ask yourself, what am I thankful for? How has God been kind to me? Where have I experienced the grace and the mercy of God right now, where I'm at, right here? What has God given me that I could look at and say, you are amazing? And let that push you into a place, or draw you into a place of praise.